From the WTSR studios at the College of New Jersey, welcome to a TCNJ Magazine podcast. Our guests, Professors Judah Bennett, Winifred Brown-Gloud, Cassandra Jackson, and Piper Kendricks-Williams, just published a highly regarded group memoir called The Toni Morrison Book Club. Cultural critic Roxane Gay leads a lively discussion about race, identity, and Morrison's legacy. TCNJ, one of the nation's top-ranked public colleges, delivers a high-quality education in a collaborative and supportive environment. Here now, from our Ewing, New Jersey campus, is the book club.
All right. So I read your book yesterday.
Oh, yay!
Oh, boy!
And this is an interesting book. It's a group memoir in many ways.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you guys decide to become a book club, first of all? Because without the book club, there would be no book.
I don't think.
And also three black women and one white guy.
Yes.
How did that happen?
And one Jamaican. And I mean, we're interesting in all our different.
Yeah. I don't think we knew that it was a book club at first. So I went, I hatched a plan, but then it had its own life. You know, so I had an idea and I threw that idea out to Cassandra saying, hey, what if we were to write sort of something between memoir, cultural criticism, but also literary criticism using Morrison as our muse? And Cassandra was the first person I asked, and I'll let her take it.
And I
there.
Said, oh, hell no. I just thought all these people have written about Morrison. I felt like there were so many people who feel a certain kind of ownership over her legacy. It felt, honestly, it felt intimidating, but it also felt too big in a way. So I just told him, you know, get Winnie to agree to do it and I'll do it. Because okay. I knew she would say no. I didn't say Piper because she says yes to everything. So I was like, just, you know, run it by Winnie, and I thought I was rid of him. And then you ran it by Winnie.
Yeah, and because I'm out of the four of us, I'm the sociologist. I don't really do a lot of work with literature, and so I guess Cassandra must have thought that, you know, I would shy away from it. And but when Judah asked me to be a part of this project, I thought it was so exciting because it would stretch me in so many ways. And so I just jumped on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd say more importantly, I thought you would stretch the group because you are coming from such a different place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah.
So what are your academic backgrounds?
Mm-hmm. I'm Piper. I got my PhD in English, but I'm joining a point in English and African-American studies. So I teach African-American literature primarily, mm-hmm. 19th and 20th century.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm joint appointed with sociology and African American studies, and I'm the chair of African American studies, and my research is on race and racial formation in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm in English, and I do mostly 19th century African American and American lit with an emphasis on like visual studies stuff. So and sometimes bouncing between the 19th and the 20th century. And I'm affiliated with African American studies, but I'm fully in an English department, and my PhD is in English.
Yeah. And my PhD is in English also, but I came out of a very conservative PhD program, and I kept trying to work in areas where people would say, oh, no, that's not something that we do, you should do. And I was discouraged every step of the way from doing the work that I wanted to do. But then once I had my PhD, I just spread my wings.
Amazing how the PhD will do that for you.
Yeah, indeed.
So you guys had this book club and you started to see threads in your own lives reflected in Toni Morrison's literature. And one of the most interesting things about the book was the way in which it was structured around a novel for every chapter. And so how did you settle on that as the structure for the book? Because as a writer, I'm always interested in the structural choices that people make for their own work.
I think when Judah approached us with it, he had the idea of four novels and that we would each write about two. And so I think the structure was part of the
You give me too much credit for having a vision.
Yeah, you did. That
was
you.
I think the idea of two people doing one novel evolved, especially when people started fighting over who got to do The Bluest Eye, who got to do Beloved. I was like, oh, maybe it doesn't have to be one person per one novel per person. But
yeah. That's how I remember it, too. I don't know. Some of us did feel really strongly about writing about certain books. I know I did. At one point, I was like, well, I'm not doing it if I can't write about Beloved. So I think some of us felt really strongly about it. But the truth is, like, even though I am someone who's really obsessed normally with structure, I do feel like this structure came out pretty organically. Because it was developing as we were having conversations and disagreements about the meaning of the text and like what it had, how it spoke to us, right? And and so it at some point it seemed like there had to be more than one voice talking about each of the books that we included,
right?
Because our responses were so different, and they were different because of our biographies being so different.
And I don't think I knew that Winnie was from Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And that might have been why I said, why don't we do a Mercy? And I also love that novel, and I feel like people are not paying enough attention to it. And Piper and Winnie both seem to take the suggestion and run with it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, one of the things I noticed is that you guys are not afraid to talk about race. And the ways in which race complicates how we interact in the world. And so how did you get to a place of being able to have those difficult conversations without, for example, making the white guy feel comfortable in his whiteness? Especially because you bring up the Morrison interview with Terry Gross, who I've been interviewed by her, and she does have some blind spots. She's a very good interviewer, but she has some blind spots, and that she was only able to see Morrison's father as this sort of ogre when he was actually protecting his family, made for a complicated conversation. And you guys talk about gun violence. You talk about whiteness and the role that whiteness plays. So how did you get to that place? Or was it just something that was also organic in your dynamic?
I do think it was organic in our dynamic, in part, though, because we all had different relationships with each other to begin with. Uh-huh. Yeah. So we were already in a place where we could have conversations like that when we started. But I would say this, the first time we met was, we had discussed the project prior to this, but the first time we sat down in a room together was after the election in 2016. And it felt like we could not have these conversations.
Right.
Like it felt necessary for us to have brave conversations, right, about the workings of race as we were essentially seeing, you know, this rise in white nationalism happening before our eyes and seeing evidence of it all around us coming into our spaces. One of the things that we had to really think about was we wanted to be able to have conversations about race at the same time, you know, and we wanted them to feel relevant to this moment. Mm-hmm. But we also, I mean, there were ways in which the you know, political chaos, I felt like we were worried about it actually taking over the book at one point.
Right.
So if anything, though, when I think about the conversations about race, the group was becoming, in reflection, I realize, a support group in that way.
Yeah.
As we were managing our own, you know, emotional responses to what was happening around us, I think.
I think it also helped that we were already friends. So, like, I have a test out in the world where I live. Like, can I talk to someone about race? Mm-hmm. And so if I bring something up and they're, like, all uncomfortable, but I felt like I already knew, you know, Cassandra, Winnie, and I would close our door and gripe about our colleagues already about, you know, being black women on a white campus. And, you know, Judah was always someone that I never thought, like, oh, here's someone I cannot have a conversation with about race. And there's definitely white people you cannot talk to about race. So I think that helped us. And that friendship grew in the process, really allowed us to deal with the, you know, we were starting in, I guess, 16 all the way through 18. So it's a very strange time in America. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, one of the things that we really loved about Judah is that Judah was not afraid to question whiteness, right, and his own white privilege. And I remember just throughout the entire process, there are chapters that did not chapters that Judah wrote that did not make the book, where he's really trying to wrap his mind around and interrogate whiteness. But just his willingness to even go there with us. I think brought us closer as a group. And so I think part of it is that we talked about race because we felt that we could do that. You know, that it was safe for us to be honest and open and vulnerable in those kinds of discussions.
Were there ever any tensions that you were not able to resolve when you were talking about anything, not necessarily race?
We were thinking this through because someone asked us this question recently, and there were never any big blow-ups or any big disagreements that were actually like angry or hostile or anything that came close. The one thing I did say to someone was that you remember I said to you that I told you that I wouldn't do it unless Winnie did it. He did go to Winnie and say, you know what, I'm pretty sure Cassandra's on board. There was that.
Yeah.
You know, and of course he, you know, then came back to me and said, oh, Winnie's on board, which shocked me. But the truth is, like, I feel like we already, I don't know, like, we already have pretty extraordinary relationships. And we already had a place of honesty between us.
Yeah.
You know, but in terms of tensions, though, the one thing that I would say was at least akin to that was getting information out of Winnie, which is not easy. And it took us a long time to be able to get to a place where, you know, I would be in a room and there'd be something maybe I thought I knew about Winnie, and I would assume that everybody else in the room knew that thing, you know, and I would suddenly realize maybe not everybody did know that thing. And, like, it was harder for some of us to open up than others. And we had kind of made this pact that if we're going to do this, we're going to tell the truth.
Yeah.
Right. That there'd be no, what reason is there to write if you're not going to tell the truth? So I felt like that was the piece of it. And when Winnie cracked open, I was like, oh, we got this. because she was, you know, sort of the emotional Fort Knox of the group at the time. You want to talk about that,
Winnie?
I guess, you know, I had to give myself permission to open that box, right? To be angry, to be fearful, and to share that anger and fear and be good about it. You know, feel okay about it. Don't chastise myself as, you know, about it. And so it took a while. It took a little while for me to go there. And a part of it also has to do with, I had to keep my vault sealed when I first came to this country as a family because of our undocumented status. And so that sort of stuck with me into my adult years. So I think that had to be, you know, my friends had to chip through that as well.
Yeah.
There were moments where we would get together around oftentimes my kitchen table. And we didn't even know where we were going, or we thought we were just talking about process or how to shape chapters. And all of a sudden, it would not devolve, but it would just evolve into just chatting as friends.
Yeah.
And then somebody would say something, and if I could give the example, Winnie would say, well, you know, Eddie and I were debating whether we should buy a gun for protection. And we're like, what? And so the whole group, it's almost like we would surround her and say, you got to write it. You got to write it.
Yeah.
Yes. That actually reminds me of something that I also thought was very interesting, which is how each of you had a secret.
Yeah.
And you share that secret, which requires quite a lot of vulnerability. And so wanting to buy a gun for protection, I think, especially in a world where Black bodies are all too often the targets of guns, is a really difficult thing. And especially as academics, we tend to think of ourselves as liberal and beyond gun ownership.
Yeah.
And yet I too have found myself, especially in the past 2 years, thinking as my profile has increased, I have thought, perhaps I should own a gun.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because I have a brother who's a gun owner. And I still haven't decided what I'm going to do. But, you know, I was really interested in that you were able to bring that to the group and to talk about thinking about gun ownership and wrapping your mind around gun ownership, mm-hmm. not only as just a human being, but as a Black woman. So I would love for you to talk more about that.
Yeah, I mean, we're still having that conversation. And a lot of it, for me at least, has to do with just fear and questioning what have I gotten to? Look at where I've gotten to, you know, that I'm now at the point where I have to even think about that, you know, whereas I didn't have to think about safety. I didn't have to think about gun ownership until now. And it pisses me off. It angers mm-hmm. me that I have to do that and that I have to think about that, not only for my own safety, but the safety of my husband, the safety of my child. I just want to be able to just live and just be, you know? And, so I'm still working through that anger, of trying to mm-hmm. process that. I grew up with a gun in my house. My husband, you know, is from Mississippi. He grew up with a gun in the house. And, you know, mm-hmm. I guess it's not just the gun ownership. It's why, right? I feel like I have to do this because I don't feel safe because of all that's going on. And it's that have to that still pisses me off. And I'm still trying to work through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's a lot to work through.
Yeah.
And that position of having to or feeling like you have to.
Right.
That you are so unsafe that you have to take your own protection. You have to take your protection into your own hands.
Because right.
You can't trust that someone else will provide it. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly frustrating, especially in a country that always tells us that we're safe.
Right.
And that this is where we are always going to be protected. That's not the case. It's no. rarely the case.
Mm-hmm. No, no. And the expectation that despite the evidence that we're not safe, they're still selling us that narrative that, no, you can trust the police. No, you can. We'll take care of you. No, the evidence doesn't suggest that. Mm-hmm. So just mm-hmm. be honest with me.
What other ways do you think this world is not honest with us?
Oh, it's not honest about our past. It's not honest about lynching, racial violence, terrorism, slavery as the economic foundation of the country. Evangelicals as really motivated by race. There's a lot of, you know, because I think another thing we do is we talk about race in our classrooms. So we're used to confront. It's almost like we can imagine an audience because we meet these kids from New Jersey who never had to think that maybe their segregated neighborhood is intentional as opposed to like just how it happened. But the secrets are interesting because they came later in the process. Some of our reading response back wanted us to do more with our showing how the book was written and our process. And so it was interesting how we had finished almost in some ways. And then those secret conversations came kind of late in the process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cassandra and I often talk about our different experiences in the classroom where as a white person, I may be able to talk about race or a novel about African-American identity in a different way and have a different response than from students. And then as a gay man, I often feel very nervous about talking about sexuality representations. And Cassandra is fearless and often talks about queer identity, queer politics in her classroom. And I'm like, oh, gosh, maybe that's what you're seeing it from the reverse side mm-hmm. for me. And so I so admire your ability to mm-hmm. put that all out there in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And it makes me realize, oh, I'm really being very cautious in some areas mm-hmm. and fearless, or at least emboldened in other areas. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You were asking about honesty.
Yeah.
And like, what else is our country not honest about? And I do feel like this is a book that's trying to talk back to that and sort of using Morrison as our inspiration to do that, mm-hmm. right? Because if anything is her legacy, it was definitely mm-hmm. speaking those difficult truths. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I feel as though we, in many ways, were inspired by that and wanted right, to be able to contribute that. We talk in the intro a little bit about this idea of what it means to live in a moment that people were calling post-truth, right? Mm-hmm. And I do feel like that's where some of the secret telling came from in the book. And Piper is right. We weren't calling them secrets in the beginning. It was sort of like, Winnie, why won't you talk about blah, you know? And we weren't calling it a secret. I think it was really sort of in reflection that we recognize, right, that there's something incredibly radical about the truth. Yeah. You know, that, you know, and that felt frankly like freeing and empowering, right, to be able to sit in a space and safely tell the truth, because there aren't a lot of places where we feel that kind of safety.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because Audre Lorde talks about this a lot in her writing, that our silence will not save us.
Yeah. Right.
And we certainly see that exemplified by everything Toni Morrison did. And she was always radical with, well, I don't know. I don't like to deify people who didn't want to be deified, but I found that she regularly was very radical in her truth-telling, and she was willing especially to make white people uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so what for each of you is the most radical truth that you share in this book, and what do you think is the most radical truth that comes from Toni Morrison's novels?
I think my radical truth was sharing the fact that I sometimes get very angry at mothers of white sons because they don't have to experience the fear that I feel raising my son. That, for me, is my radical truth. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me think about the title of Toni Morrison.
Okay, think about it.
What's your radical truth?
Is Piper the quiet one?
No.
No.
I guess the hardest thing for me to talk about is really my secret experience growing up in Southbury, Connecticut, as the only black girl trying to get through puberty, dating, being viewed. Well, when people were attracted to me, being viewed in that like that exotic, weird way that now I learned to call fetish, but like when I was 15, 16, didn't know. And just I can remember the moment in the conference room when Cassandra, who knew me at Spelman, was like, what about, you know, that white guy, but that other one and the one in math class. And just the idea that they were racking up. Was kind of frightening.
I'd be like, no, not that white guy, the other white guy. Honestly, I feel like I had a couple. One was in terms of like the radical truth that came out of the process. One was thinking about the mental illness in my family and all the other names that we had given to it. And, you know, living in this space where, because I grew up in rural Alabama, in a community where there, was a lot of segregation and poverty, and we grew up working class. And I think that we had really been calling mental illness everything but mental illness, in part because, you know, there wasn't necessarily treatment available for the things that we were experiencing, but and also because of real fear about what it meant to be black and experiencing mental illness. And that was one of the things I had to really think about, in part because I had these, you know, sort of stories that my mother would tell me. That were told as jokes, right? Like the time my brother tried to kill me with an axe is not a joke, you know? But that humor was her way of really talking about these things and just sort of, you know, just coming to terms with it and recognizing. And so The Bluest Eye was the book that really made me think about that. Right. You know, because I feel like I didn't understand the end of the book. I remember reading it, you know, in college, 18 years old. I get to the end of the book and I don't know where Pecola went. You know, I'm not understanding because in my mind, black women and girls, they don't go crazy. Right. You get stronger.
We're not allowed to go crazy.
We're not allowed to go crazy. Exactly. Right. You know, you're supposed to be like, you know, a Maya Angelou poem or something. You don't get to crack up. And it's like there's a way in which not recognizing that for what it was its own punishment because it meant not being able to get resources. It meant not being able really sort of to recognize the pain. Right. That was causing, you know, and that it led to a lot of this mental illness, you know. Yeah.
I don't know if it's in the book. I think it actually got taken out. But there's a very small event that happened to me when I was in high school where for a brief time I became friends with this black guy who sat right in front of me. And at one point he turned around from his seat and he said, "So, do you have other black friends?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, you should think about that." And I get emotional just telling the story because I've been meditating on that for like the last 50 years to think about all the different ways that he was giving me a gift to just, you know, very gently prod me and say, think about what it means to be white you and your place in this world. And I feel like I've been, I have been trying to address that. But, you know, I also live in a racist world, which means sometimes as a white person, I see things that my co-writers don't see, right? Where another white person will feel like, oh, I can just say this because you're white, I'm white. And so there's a lot of stuff that I feel like over the course of a lifetime that I'm constantly trying to process in order to be a better human being.
When people invite you into that experience of racism, and I do know that what you're talking about, because it's happened to me where it's happened a few times, but the time that I always think about is when I was living in rural Indiana, and the woman at the dry cleaner was talking about those people after this Asian man had just left the establishment. And I just thought, oh my God, she thinks that she can invite me into this racist discourse and that I'm going to willingly participate. And the answer was no, I was not. And you know, you can't fight every battle every moment of every day because there's only so many hours in the day. You only have so much emotional energy to expend on educating others outside of the classroom. But what do you do in those moments where people invite you into racist discourse without recognizing that you're not like them?
Well, the stories that first come to mind paint me out to be virtuous, and I'd be more interested if I, you know, when I leave here, I'll probably think about all the moments where I maybe didn't speak up as much. But, you know, one thing that immediately came to my mind was when you were talking about Indiana, and I was in graduate school in WashU, and there was somebody at a deli counter who, after three little girls left and they were asking for a taste of something, she, as you were saying, was trying to draw me into her you know, sort of racist world. And I can't remember the epithet she used for them. But I just remember as clear as day saying, "So not cool." And then running to the manager, asking to speak to a manager. So that's just such a little thing. But really, what I think you're really getting after, and I really have to inspect it more clearly, are all the moments where there's some veiled, or it's like you're not sure even how you intervene because it's maybe subtle or right. or I didn't. I had a student once. Okay, here's a perfect example. I had a student once who said that, yeah, she was going to transfer after 2 years here, and she said she went to a certain campus, but it was very dark. And I was like, oh, I innocent me. I was thinking about the lighting. And then I mentioned it to somebody. I was like, oh, God, is that code for that there were going to be a lot of black people on campus? And they said, yeah, that's what she was talking about. And so I was like, God, now it's after the fact. I can't even respond right in the moment because I'm so dumb. And she's still in my class. And like, do I call her up and say, what was going on with that? And so there are a million moments like that, right? Where somebody is drawing you into mm-hmm. something and you're like, am I complicit? Do I even understand it? You know, am I taking on everything? So, yeah, it's painful.
Now, what do you guys want readers to take from this book?
Well, I think when you asked what the secret that Morrison offers, I was thinking back to this moment I have where some interviewer asked her, you know, why don't you ever write about white people? Mm-hmm. And she was like, please, no one asks white authors that. And I think the right. truth that she gives us is that we're human. Mm-hmm. Black people are mm-hmm. human. And so in our full complex humanity, she shows us in our relationships and our choices in the way that we carry trauma. And I just love that in the black world that she creates, we're people. And I think for some people yeah. who have a hard time encountering us as like people who are like them, that's her radical truth.
Mm-hmm. And to build on that, you know, the fact that, you know, she was not afraid to say, hey, white folk, y'all need to work out your racism. That's your luggage to carry. It's not ours. And just unapologetically, you know, and I think, one of the things that we hope readers will take away from this book is the power of truth, right? And those secrets. And that when we think about memoirs, when we think about book clubs, they can be healing moments or healing spaces as well, where we can speak truths, and be unapologetic about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would add to that, though, just read Morrison.
Like, yeah.
So, you know, because like one of the early titles of the book was like, Who's Afraid of Toni Morrison? And mm-hmm. We got rid of the title because we realized it did actually scare people even more. Mm-hmm. But at the time, you know, I was the one who was scared. Remember, that's my secret, right? I was really scared. And here I am with a PhD in English, you know, been reading her, you know, since I was a teenager and still feeling, you know, sort of intimidated by the idea of entering this big conversation about her, which is something that, you know, like that, frankly, a lot of scholars have made that a conversation that is difficult to enter, right? Because, you know, they're speaking in jargon and they're, you know, really not so much sometimes trying to clarify as they are in some ways wanting to engage in, you know, an exclusive scholarly conversation. And that, say, my mother might not be able to engage in. And I want the people who aren't part of that kind of conversation to read this book and recognize, right, that Toni Morrison has something for you, too. She wasn't writing for those people. She was probably writing for you, right? She wasn't writing to be written about, you know? I think that, you know, the idea of her work is something that art that is accessible and meaningful to so many people is something that we have to, you know, recognize. And in some ways, I kind of wanted to take her work back from that other conversation and be able to find this space in which, you know, she is part of the community as opposed to this deity. As well.
Yeah. Do you guys think about accessibility in your own scholarly work and writing beyond the academy? And if so, what are some of the strategies that you use to do that, to break that barrier that we're always encouraged to stay within?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I try to think about it at the level of the sentence, right? I try in my own writing to stay away from jargon because I think that that can be a barrier. When I write my books, my articles, I try to write it thinking about my mother because I want my mother to read it. Well, some of the things, but not all. But the things that I want my mama to read, I want her to be able to understand it. And, you know, I remember when I was in graduate school, it was all during the period of post-structuralism and everybody was talking all these wonderful post-structuralist language. And I'm not hating on post-structuralism, but half of the time it took me, you know, I had to go pull out my dictionary and said, okay, what are you saying? And then when I figure it out, I'm like, really? This is what you're trying to say? You know, it really isn't that deep. You know, after I had to do all that labor to figure it out. And that for me, during my, you know, college, graduate school years really left this feeling in my heart that, you know what, I need to write in a way that my mama, my grandmama can read it and access it. Mm-hmm. So at the level of the sentence, I try to think of it in that way.
I never felt that reservation. So when I wrote my dissertation, every chapter started with a family story because I wanted to get a PhD to kind of understand myself and my family. And my chair of my dissertation told me you have to take those out. And so I guess I now know, and I never got the, to me, all these intellectual questions were first, are like, the intellectual is personal. Mm-hmm. And my family is a story that needs critical understanding of. So I was the one who had already sort of written about myself in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of like the making the writing accessible, it became increasingly important to me after my first book, which was like this, you know, very, you know, standard scholarly book that you write for tenure. And I'm not saying there weren't ideas in it that weren't interesting to me. But I am saying that, I don't know, the parts of my biography that inspired it did not make it into the book. And and I felt really trapped by that kind of writing. Like I felt like I was being told to dance, you know, in a cage. It just felt like, that I was not my authentic self while I was doing that kind of work. And then with the second book, I feel like I didn't have any choice but to explore the personal. And for some reason, when I'm exploring the personal, that's really where the conversational language comes back to me, right? Because I feel like I can't do that. Because I feel like the scholarly language is about distance and distancing and creating, you know, the illusion of distance. And, you know, that one can't do that, or for me, I couldn't do that in personal writing. And so it was really with the second book, where I was writing about much more sort of painful material. I was looking at basically sort of images of Black people whose bodies had been victimized. So I was looking at like photographs of slaves and thinking about, you know, trying to move from this idea of slaves to enslaved people and sort of recognizing, you know, recognizing the ways in which violence can impact people's lives. And so when I was doing that kind of work, I felt the need, right? I had to figure out why I wanted to look at something so gruesome because people kept asking me. They were like, why are you looking at this much violence? Why do you want to examine these kinds of images? Why? And I had no choice but to spend some time thinking about my own sort of personal biography and my own, you know, certain kinds of fears because I had, you know, sort of grown up, you know, in an area where the Klan was still active and where I saw them, you know, sometimes on the street and had real fears about what that meant and what might happen to people in my family because of that. And so I feel like I couldn't get the book written without admitting it. I could tell that something was not on the page, right, that was compelling me to write and that I had to figure out what it was before I could finish the book. And I feel like that was the shift for me because I went from, you know, feeling, you know, kind of blasé about academic and scholarly writing to feeling like, no, that's a trap that they want you to fall into, right? Like, that's a trap, you know, that somebody, you know, because Because if you start speaking, right, from that personal place, right, with that kind of and the truth that that requires, you're going to make somebody uncomfortable. Somebody's not going to like it. People don't – nobody wants to – you know, I'm not saying – I shouldn't say nobody, but I have a lot of colleagues who don't want to sit in a room and know certain things about you because it's going to change the conversation, right, if they understand those experiences or even aware of those experiences in a different way. And there's power in that kind of telling. Right. And so, yeah, once I got over that hump with that second book, I think that was it for me. You know, I think at that point I was really done with this old kind of scholarly writing and thinking about the ways in which the personal and the political had to intersect if I was going to write.
I think that shift from academic writing to what we've tried to do with this book was not easy for all of us, maybe for any of us. And for me, I think I recognized how much I had become steeped in the jargon, in the tools that sometimes have a purpose, not just to obfuscate. And so all of us were constantly on each one of us to say, wait a minute, do you have to say it that way? In fact, there was a point where we also had footnotes. Wait a minute. Could we just get rid of footnotes? Yeah. Why not? And then there were some terms that remained that we really had to inspect, like, will your mother understand this term? Yeah. So I don't think it was easy.
No, it wasn't.
So where does the book club go from here? Is there another writer that you want to tackle as a sort of to look at their body of work?
Cassandra's still saying, hell no. I guess I wasn't as strategic this time around because I've already pitched an idea and she's still saying, hell no.
They want to do Baldwin. Yeah, they want to do Baldwin.
You want to do what? Baldwin?
Yeah, yeah. They want to do Baldwin.
They want to do Baldwin.
Cassandra's
Baldwin
still thinking that
choice.
Through.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And a tempting choice.
Let her speak. Let her speak.
No, I mean, I could already see the second book, Finding Baldwin. You guys are absolutely on the right track.
If you really want to fangirl her, listen.
Oh, that's awesome.
Okay, that's Roxanne awesome. Gay said do it.
So. I did. I did indeed.
I thought you would back away if I said it that way.
And now can we go right with the same model? Like now we know what we're doing. So four books, like that's the only thing I wonder, like, have we struck on something really like originary? And then what would it be to like try to recreate it? And I'd want to still be able to have that organic experience unfold about how we were going to figure out.
Yeah.
The way that we would engage with like a new author.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do feel like having this supportive space was also helpful with other writing that we were all doing at the same time. Yeah. Because it's, once again, it's, you know, just having that sort of safe space where someone is also kind of pushing you. That there's something, you know, I don't know. For me, there was something really unusual about that. I hadn't experienced that before. I had never been in a writing group that was successful. I mean, there's so many ways that that can go wrong.
It's challenging. Yeah. I've only been in one that was successful, and I missed them every day because I moved, and it just wasn't feasible long distance. I really loved the in-personness of it, and I've never found it again.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, no pressure.
No pressure. Love you.
You're welcome, Judah. I think that's all I have for you because I have to get going. Yes. But what would my last question be? Well, my last question is something I tend to ask everyone I interview, which is, what do you like most about your writing and scholarship?
I told them you were going to ask that.
I knew that yesterday.
I was the only one not intimidated by that question. I like, I don't know if I achieve it, but because you never know how people are reading it. But I love moments where there's a little white space a little gap between paragraphs, a little ellipsis, where somebody can think, oh, and it's ineffable. It's not in the words. Maybe it's in the juxtaposition of paragraphs. I love that moment.
I've loved rereading different sections because we did them in such, I don't think we've, any of us have read the whole book front to back yet, even though we did. But coming back and re-experiencing just, you know, before we walked over here, rereading the afterword and thinking, oh my God, like, this is a beautiful moment and it's so true and the gift that she gave us and how she, I mean, there was this one word, shame. And it could really make my heart go. So I felt, I love that even though, like, in the process, we knew there were strong moments that we can return to it and still find, like, joy and meaning in what we produce.
Yeah, I certainly echo that. I mean, as I know, and I know you know, writing can be such an isolating experience, where it's just you and that blank paper or that blank screen, and that moment alone can be intimidating because you're like, what the hell do I want to say now? But with this process, because it was a communal process and an affirming process, a space was created where we could just take risks with our ideas. I think that for me was the most special part of it. And it's that part that I intend to take with my other writings, right? Outside of the writing group. How can I just think about the process of writing as not intimidating? This has really sort of helped me, because for me, I am in the process of learning to like my writing. I'm not there, but this has brought me closer. Writing is a little less intimidating for me because of this, and so I intend to take that experience in my other sociological work.
Yeah,
so, that's awesome. And it's so rare that people will admit that they're not 100% there yet. But I'm glad that the process of the book has gotten you closer.
Indeed.
Yeah, it's, as you said that, I can't start thinking, like, is anybody 100% there? But, like, for me, in terms of, like, what I like about it, like, so writing is the way that I think through everything. So, you know, we were talking yesterday, reflecting on when Toni Morrison passed away and hearing about it and how stunning it was. And we were told almost immediately, you know, that we needed to write an afterword, a different afterword for the book, because we had already done the proofs and everything at that point. And the only way that I could work through that moment of her passing was to write it. You know, it was like I could not understand what that moment meant to me, what it meant to us, without actually engaging in the writing. It is a healing process for me, as well as, you know, a way of coming to terms with myself in a way that is honest in terms of what goes on the page. And so I think that that is what I like about it, right? It's meaningful to me about it, yeah.
Awesome. I appreciate hearing that. I love hearing what writers say to this question every single time. It never gets old.
Thank you for taking your time.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you so much.
Okay, this was awesome.
Thank you for this book. I'm really looking forward to people reading it.